thank God for a product, the name of which I can't remember now, but it's ibuprofen gel with menthol in it, applied liberally to the back. And if I can remember the name, I'll recommend it to you later. But it's very good. And if there are shares for sale in it, I'll buy some. Coming down, I was thinking again of how long I've been friends with Alex and Sian. I met Alex, I remember it was a Friday at the beginning of October in 1989. I can be so precise because it was the October 1989 that I began working at Harvest Books and Crafts in Pontypridd. And Alex always came in on a Friday because that's the day he was up in Pontypridd Magistrates Court. So he always came over. And in the shop where I worked, we sold filter coffee in a little dispenser. You place the filter coffee on the cup and then you filled it, Rombos, that's right, and then you filled it with water. Only I served up a very strong cup of coffee to Alex that day because I accidentally put two of these Rombo filters. And I don't know if Alex remembers that, but I could see him going, yeah, that, yeah. So he went back to work that afternoon wired. he'd had a caffeine overload. Right. So I want to tell you a story. As Max Bygraves used to say, please bear with me. Looking out of the window in the back bedroom of my father's house, a room which was for many years my bedroom, you can see the western flank of the valley, the Rhondda Valley, where I am. Was born and raised and where I still live. And you can see where the part of the mountain comes together and forms a little pass. And my father told me once that this is what was known to everybody years ago as the Gugu level. Gugu being Welsh for cuckoo, as Sian will tell us. I hope I'm right there, Sian. Is that right? Yeah. It's South Walian Welsh. Yeah. And apparently that's the little pass that the miners used to take. They would walk over the mountain to Clydachwael before they began their day's work. And then, of course, at the end of a long, hard shift, they would take that route back, walking home. My grandfather apparently used to walk that way to work. Anyway, I know that part of the mountain very well because I spent, during my youth, a long time, many hours, staring out of that window. I'd get up in the morning, of course, and pull the curtains, and that was the sight that I would see. And because the sun doesn't always shine in the Rhondda, believe it or not, there were and are many days when I can still see that from my front, from my lounge window now. And there are many days where that part of the mountain appears very grey, very flat, very monochrome because of the weather and because of the light. But there are days when it's sunny, few and far between, unfortunately. And when the sunlight shines on that section of the mountain and the view of that section of the mountain becomes so clear, so intense, that the grass and the trees and the bushes, they seem to become transformed. And you can see details that you wouldn't necessarily see. And their true colours are shown in all their glory, so to speak. And I think of that sometimes when I read this story of the Transfiguration, which was read to us earlier. Thank you. The Transfiguration, the word, of course, Transfiguration, which also means transformation, a story in which Jesus is revealed in all his glory. And it's the story of the Transfiguration, which I suggest is the way to understand what Mark is saying to us about what it means to follow Jesus. And no doubt in weeks to come, as you begin at the beginning, which, as Julie Andrews would remind us, is a very good place to start. As you begin at the beginning of Mark's gospel and work through, you'll gain other insights, of course. But right here, from chapter 8, verse 27, with all of the warnings that come there, through to chapter 9 and everything that happens there, the warning from Jesus that if you want to be his disciple, it's going to be tough, through to the Transfiguration, followed by warnings from Jesus about what's going then to happen to him. This story here, flanked on either side by these warnings, and not only at the center of Mark's gospel, but are what Eugene Peterson calls the spirituality of Mark's text. This is what Mark is all about. And Mark, most scholars will agree, was the earliest of the gospels to be written. And as Bishop Papias said in the late first century, early second century, he said that they were the recollections of Peter taken down by John Mark, arranged by him, and then presented to the early church as an encouragement to them on their way as disciples. And this story is a story of Jesus going into a lonely, mountainous place to pray, attended by his three closest friends, Peter, James, and John. A story in which Jesus, as he prays in solitude, enters into a mystery so great that his friends shrink from it and have no words for it. Because what's happening before them is outside the realm of their experience. Jesus is transfigured, and they get a glimpse of his true nature, his glory, his transcendence. And in that transcendence, in that glory, live the law and the prophets, Moses and Elijah, the best that Israel offers. But it overwhelms them, it confounds them. They're at a loss because what they see is so far beyond their ability to comprehend. Past and present, it seems, telescope together into this dazzling present. Moses and Elijah, standing for the law and the prophets, the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, the setting in which Jesus' work makes sense. Moses and Elijah both had met God on a mountain. Moses in an earthquake, wind and fire. Elijah in a still, small voice. Which was this more like? And then Peter, good old Peter, eventually finds some words. The first, it seems, that come into his head. Good old Peter, representing us all. And then come the cloud and the voice, a presence above and beyond the heroes of the past. This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. The words confirming what was said at Jesus' baptism, assuring the terrified watchers that Jesus really is the Messiah and that his call to follow him must be obeyed. And then suddenly it's over. I don't know if you've ever had an experience similar to that. Not the Transfiguration, but something you've seen of God. Something new. Something wonderful. Something so above and beyond what you would normally expect. And then all of a sudden it's over. It happens like that very often. Suddenly it's over. There's only Jesus, and you'd think after that there would be plenty to talk about and many excited questions, but it seems not. Because as they're coming down the mountain, We read, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, Mark tells us, discussing what rising from the dead meant. So instead of excited chatter and over-the-top joy, a cloud is cast again over the proceedings. Back to the cuckoo level. Looking out the window in the 1980s, the light and the lack of it seemed very much then, as it does so often now, to mirror my moods, my Christian commitment, and my faith. Looking at that view, an understanding then of how the weather changes in one day comes home to you. How you can have blazing sunlight illuminating the mountain, showing up, as I said, all the details. You can see a bush, you can see a bush, and it's swaying in the breeze, and you can see the individual branches of the bush swaying. And then all of a sudden, a cloud comes over and you're back into shadow again. I don't know if you've had days like that, when your faith seems to be up and down. One moment you feel as though you could take on the world with your commitment to Christ, and the next minute something happens and you're, oh, again, and you don't know what's happening. Sunlight and shadow days, I call those days. And there are many of them. I have many of them. Jeff Lucas, do you know him? Jeff Lucas was speaking at Spring Harvest, this is going back about 25 years ago. And I had forgotten completely about this, but what he said made such an impression on a friend of mine, who's a Baptist minister. He remembered it, and he reminded me, and this is why I tell you about it now. Jeff Lucas once said at Spring Harvest, he said, you know, I go around all of these wonderful churches and I meet loads of people and we worship together and God meets with us. And I'm very encouraged, he said, by what's going on in the church. And I walk out after the meeting and I stand there and I think to myself, I wonder if there is a God. He prefaced that by saying, I'm going to tell you something now that many of you will find shocking, but some of you will find very, very liberating. And then he told us that story. And it made such an impression on a friend of mine that he remembered that, and it encouraged him very much. There are days, it seems, when faith is up and down, up and down. I'm going to read this to you now. It may really, it's a bit disjointed. It doesn't really fit in with the rest of what my sermon is about. But because I love him, C.S. Lewis, the man was a genius, I'm going to tell you anyway. He said this, C.S. Lewis. Now, faith, in the sense in which I am here using the word, is the art of holding on to things your reason has accepted in spite of your changing moods. For moods will change, whatever view your reason takes. I know that by experience. Now that I'm a Christian, I do have moods in which the whole thing looks very improbable. But when I was an atheist, I had moods in which Christianity looked terribly probable. This rebellion of your moods against your real self is going to come anyway. This is why faith is such a necessary virtue. Unless you teach your moods where to get off, you can never be either a sound Christian or even a sound atheist, but just a creature dithering to and fro with its beliefs really dependent on the weather and the state of its digestion. Right, I'm going to sit down now, that's it. If you remember nothing more about what I say, remember that, please. back to the story of the Transfiguration. They're coming down the mountain after having seen what they've seen. But here, the story becomes darker still. All the gospel writers follow the story of the Transfiguration with the story of a boy who's desperately ill, so sick, in fact, that the disciples hadn't been able to cure him. And all the gospel writers seem to be telling us that the two go together, the mountaintop experience and the shrieking, stubborn demon. What do I mean? Well, where are we in the story? Not far back from this account that Mark gives us is the account of Peter's confession at Caesarea Philippi. It's really quite something. It's really telling that when Jesus wants the disciples to relax, take some time out with him, what does he do? He takes them off into non-Jewish territory. Caesarea Philippi was known for its big monument, this huge cave dedicated to the pagan god Pan. And so Jesus takes his disciples to pagan central, where Peter is going to make his confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And again, is there wild celebration following that confession? No. Jesus warns them, don't say anything to anyone. The Transfiguration comes next with the warnings from Jesus not to tell anyone until the Son of Man is risen from the dead. After this incredible experience, warnings. Now Mark, like all the gospel writers, is a very skillful storyteller. And it seems that for him, transfiguration and crucifixion go together. The glory, the revealing of Jesus, followed by this warning that Jesus is going to die. Here, on a mountain, probably Mount Tabor, Jesus is revealed in glory. A few chapters later, there, on a hillside outside Jerusalem, Jesus is revealed in shame. Here, his clothes are shining white. There, they've been stripped off and soldiers have gambled for them. Here, he's flanked by Moses and Elijah, two of Israel's greatest heroes. There, he's flanked by two rebels, two brigands, representing the level to which Israel had sunk in its rebellion against God. Here, a bright cloud, overshadows the scene. There, darkness comes upon the land. Here, Peter blurts out the first thing that comes into his head, Lord, it's good for us to be here. Let's build two tabernacles. There, he's hiding in shame after denying that he even knows Jesus. Here, a voice from God declares that this is my wonderful son. There, a pagan soldier declares in surprise that this really is God's son. The sunlight and the shadow, the light and the darkness, constant themes throughout Mark, as you'll see in the weeks to come. Things that are so very real in our own lives, light and shadow. So, Jesus, Peter, James, and John come down from the mountain and are faced with this scene. A crowd, an anguished father, a shrieking boy, and thoroughly confused disciples. You come down from the mountaintop after your experience with God, and what's the first thing you have to put up with? People. People. The church would be great, wouldn't it, if only it was full of people like me. That's what we often think. People, friends of mine who are teachers, say, do you know, my job would be so much easier if it wasn't for pupils. Nurses and doctors say, oh, I would love my job if it wasn't for patients. People. We have to do with people. Jesus is exasperated. Absolutely exasperated. Bring the boy to me. You couldn't do it? Oh, bring him here. Back to the mountain and the sunshine. The sun doesn't always shine in the Rhondda, nor in South Wales, if you hadn't noticed. And we have, as I've said already, because I want to emphasize this point, we know sunlight and shadow. We know light and we know darkness. We know the times when things are going well and the times when things are going very badly indeed. Perhaps you're not going through a sunlight and shadow day yourself. Perhaps you're going through a period of prolonged shadow and prolonged darkness. Perhaps you've had a sense of moving forward in faith, a new sense of commitment, an experience in prayer of some new understanding of God, which has filled you with enthusiasm and with joy, and there's a spring in the step of your Christian life that wasn't there before, and everything seems to be going really well. And then something happens. It's not making sense anymore. Perhaps you feel that you've hit a brick wall. You've been through an illness or a bereavement. There's a lady I know in the Rhondda, someone I've known for many years. I respect her very much. She's been a Christian for many years, a very faithful church member. And then suddenly she had this period of ill health, which has left her quite disabled. And she confessed to me once, you know, after what I went through, I picked up my Bible and I felt this attitude, this feeling coming over me. I don't know if I believe this anymore. It happens. Something perhaps you hoped for very much didn't happen. And it's not making sense anymore in the way that it did. There was a very dear lady in the church I joined when I first became a Christian. I knew her from when I was 13 years old. She's passed away now. Her name was Mrs. Parry. Mrs. Parry, I always called her. And I remember her telling me once when I was about 15 years old, she said, you know, Jonathan, she said, this time last year, I couldn't pray. Have you ever had that experience? You just can't pray even anymore. She said, the only way I could pray in the end was to buy a little book of prayers and to pray those every night. And she kept on, she persevered. And she said, in the end, the prayers in this book of prayers were expressing for me exactly how I was feeling, exactly what I wanted to say to God, but I just couldn't. Puts me in mind of that man. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Please help my unbelief. Have you ever prayed that? I pray that so often. And again, generations going way back of Christians, I believe, have found such encouragement in that cry of desperation from that father. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Because there's never been an easy time to be a Christian. And perhaps Mark's gospel was written to address that very question, to address the hardships and the trials that the first generation of Christians were going through. If, as many scholars suggest, Mark was written towards the end of the 60s, well, everything that was happening in Jerusalem at that time, in 70 AD, of course, the Roman legions went in and leveled Jerusalem. And perhaps that those beleaguered Christian communities in Palestine, they were facing such intense pressure, not just from the invading and the settling armies, but from their fellow Jews. And they knew there was never that being a Christian was not easy. They were facing intense pressure. And we feel pressure, not of the same kind, thank goodness, but we know that it's not easy to be a Christian. It's harder to believe than not to. And it isn't only our world that screams at us how futile and silly it is to believe in Jesus. Just after this episode with the desperate father and his son, Jesus has a discussion with the disciples about what it means to follow him, to be a disciple. And despite what they'd just seen, which was very necessary for them to see, he makes it clear that it's not all visions and glory. It can be that. And disillusionment, difficulties, exasperation, painful times and seasons. And therefore, we need to persevere. As a friend of mine who struggled with ill health once put it, it's often raw and real and a determined act of trust. We often find it completely bewildering to know how to understand what God is doing and saying, both in our times of great joy and our times of great sadness. But the word that comes to us, leading us on to follow Jesus, even when we haven't a clue as to what's happening, is the word that came from the cloud on that strange day in Galilee. This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. You've heard people say, you may have perhaps someone say it to you, you're hearing me, but you're not listening to me. Hearing has been defined as the process and the function or power of perceiving sound, but listening, on the other hand, means pay attention to that sound. Hear something with thoughtful attention. Give consideration to what you're actually hearing. This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. Mark is asking us, will we listen to Jesus? And not only hear him, will we listen to his voice and live our lives guided by that voice? He's going ahead of you into Galilee, as the young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side of the empty tomb said to the woman at the end of the gospel. And like them, you might often tremble and feel bewildered. But will we listen to Jesus, even when it's really tough? Will we be intentional about listening to his voice, to the witness of his life and his love? Seeing is easier. Listening is hard work. It takes more discipline and more commitment. Listening is the less glamorous work of discipleship, not chasing after the next shiny thing. And perhaps the encouragement we can take from this strange story of the Transfiguration is not only the change we are told occurred in Jesus as those three looked on, but also the change that can occur in us as we look on, as we listen carefully, and as we go forward step by single step, which is what being a disciple actually is. Many, many years later, now an old man, Peter looked back on this and he wrote the following. We did not follow cleverly devised stories when we told you about the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ in power, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory saying, "This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased." We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain. We also have the prophetic message as something completely reliable, and you will do well to pay attention to it as to a light shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. Mark is saying to us, in your following after Jesus, keep on keeping on. Listen to his voice. Pay attention to it as to a light shining in a dark place, because sometimes that's what it is, a light shining in a dark place. Because eventually the day will dawn and the morning star will rise in your hearts. Amen. First time that's ever happened.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us, Jonathan.